Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. There's a proposal in the pending state spending budget, the state operating budget, for drilling for gas and oil on state land. Here are the benefits, according to David Mustine, the director of the Ohio Department of Natural Resources.
Use of our mineral, of our natural resources, include recreation, include hunting and fishing, but also stewardship and wise use of our resources is also to help our economy.
The revenue from opening up state parks to drilling was supposed to pay for operating the state parks and also take care of a backlog of maintenance issues, a $500 million backlog. Now the amount of revenue that will be generated is unclear because the state only controls the oil and gas rights to one-third of the 115,300 acres in the state parks. And yesterday, a state lawmaker introduced a plan to limit natural gas drilling on some state lands, allowing energy companies the most access to the land that would generate the greatest revenue for the state. We invited the Ohio Department of Natural Resources to send someone who could talk about what the state estimates will be in terms of revenue from such a venture. They said that no one was available. We'll keep trying. Joining us today is Tom Stewart. He's the Executive Vice President of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. Welcome back to the show, Tom.
Thank you, Anne. Great to be here.
Also with us is Jack Shaner, another repeat guest. He's the Senior Director of Legislative and Public Affairs for the Ohio Environmental Council. Jack, welcome back.
Good morning, Anne.
The Dispatch a few weeks ago raised the specter that perhaps the state doesn't have as much to gain as was originally believed because it doesn't actually control the oil and gas rights to two-thirds of its property. Tom, what do we mean by oil and gas rights?
That would be the rights to extract oil and gas from a reservoir that's beneath the subsurface that's owned by somebody else. And when you engage into an oil and gas lease, the owner of those minerals gives the right, pursuant to a legal contract called an oil and gas lease, to a producer to drill to those reservoirs and extract that oil and gas. And in return, they get fees and royalties for getting to their property.
Is there usually an initial cash outlay to them, their initial payment?
All leases, what they fundamentally come down to is that there is no expense to the landowner or to who originally owns the mineral rights. What he will gain usually is some kind of signing bonus or signing fee. If there's several years' terms to the leases, they will get yearly rentals to keep those leases into effect. And, of course, there's always a royalty rate based upon the amount of volume, the volume of gas that is extracted out of the ground.
How long is a typical lease? How long do they last? Once you get in, how long would an oil or gas operation want the lease for?
I've seen oil and gas leases that are as short as 6 months and as long as 10 years. It's all privately negotiated between the landowner and the producer. Once the producer finds an economically productive oil and gas producing well on that property and he decides to produce that well, the lease will stay in effect so long as there's economic quantities of oil and gas being extracted.
Does a typical lease involve references to possible environmental damage that the company doing the drilling for the gas or oil would reclaim the land if there was ever any damage?
Absolutely.
That's typical?
What is more that trumps all of that is that Ohio law is very specific on environmental protections. As we've recently upgraded that law in the past General Assembly and made it more robust, but the bottom line is that nobody can go and drill an oil and gas well without having a pretty strict code of environmental compliance and restoration rights. And then, of course, the landowner can always negotiate specific issues about that matter to him above and beyond the requirements of law that he would put into that contract, and you often see something like that.
Now, what the Dispatch talked about in the story a couple of weeks ago is the fact that about two-thirds of the state park land that we know of, there's other state land out there too, but the state park land is already leased out. And Jack Shaner, what do we know about those leases, some of which date back to the 1920s, I guess?
Well, first, and thanks very much for this program. This is a good debate and a hot debate. So I just want to say fundamentally the environmental conservation community largely opposes the whole fundamental question of opening our state parks to oil and gas drilling.
Mm-hmm.
To your specific question, you're correct, and the Dispatch ably pointed out that of all the lands that the state of Ohio owns or otherwise controls of our state parks. The state does not, in fact, own all of those mineral rights, and I think we all agree upon that. So the state can't lease what it does not own, and we all agree upon that. So this is one thing that knocks down the potential revenue when you take two-thirds of the lands off the table, which, of course, I'm happy about. But that means it's not the windfall, you know, potentially that it could have been because we're taking some land that just can't lease off the table. So, and that's because many of the lands the state acquired used federal funds. Those federal funds have restrictions. They demand should the beneficiary, in this case the state of Ohio, our state park system, those park lands that were acquired with these federal dollars, should they be developed, for use other than parkland, the state has to reimburse the federal government. Potentially has to find other land to compensate the federal government. So that'd be a huge and expensive undertaking.
Is that something we know clearly, or is that just something that's unclear at this point?
Well, it is clear that that is the federal law.
Okay.
And what's unclear is exactly how many acres, exactly how many parcels, exactly how many of those parcels have restrictions. That's something that's not quite known, but clearly there are lands the state does not own as mineral rights.
The state knows that it owns about a third of the mineral rights to its land. How does it know that, and why can't we find out who owns the other two-thirds?
Well, we need to be clear about what we're talking about here. The state of Ohio probably owns the vast majority of the mineral rights underneath their lands. But because they acquired the properties through the assistance of the federal government, that encumbered those properties and how they manage those lands and how they extract value off those lands. So there's complications on large tracts of land as to whether they could lease it or not without coming to some kind of agreement with the federal government to mitigate those impacts based upon their original agreements. So apparently the DNR has looked at their inventory and concluded that there's about 34,000 acres, which is a very large block, by the way, of land that is not encumbered, and then the rest of the lands have some kind of problem based upon their relationship with the federal government. That doesn't mean that they can't repair or fix those problems or come to some kind of agreement with the federal government that would allow them to go through in the future, but they have more work to do to get that done.
Okay, so just because the state only knows of what it clearly owns outright and can control outright, doesn't mean the other two-thirds are controlled or
That's
owned
right.
by a private entity
yeah.
outside of the state.
No, not a private entity.
Or anybody.
They probably own it. But they're going to have to come to an accommodation with the federal government that will allow them to access it.
I would generally agree with that. There are two other smaller issues when you start to get in the weeds. There, in addition to the federal land acquisition, there are lands the state does own, but it's possible that some of the mineral rights below some of those parcels the state does not own, A. And then B, if you talk with the department, they will acknowledge They do not know for every single acre and every square inch out there exactly what are the rights and what are the restrictions. And they say they're going to have to do a county-by-county title search. So if a specific block of land is nominated for drilling, the state will have to determine specifically and definitively does the state have the right to even lease those lands.
Tom Stewart, was this clear to you when you first endorsed the whole plan and the budget the last time you were on the show?
Oh, yes.
So,
you know, I wasn't really clear until recently of what the encumbrances by the federal government on lands that they assisted the state in purchasing, what all that meant. Really, it comes down to an issue of control. And the way the sub-bill was written that was rolled out yesterday drives control back to the land management agencies and solves a lot of problems right there in our relationship with the government. It's also true that they do not own all of the mineral rights underneath their properties. For example, there is oil and gas producers in the state of Ohio today who own the mineral rights underneath wildlife properties and are drilling and have drilled wells on wildlife properties to get to their mineral rights. So there is private land accessing private mineral rights where the surface is owned by the state of Ohio.
Until the state knows what it owns and what it doesn't, what it controls and what it doesn't, should the state move forward in with this kind of legislation, not knowing what the outcome might be?
Well, there's 34,000 acres that they've identified that is clear and ready to go, and that's a very large lease block.
But is it worth it to the state? This is going to take a lot of legwork, a lot of shoe leather to figure out what it owns and what it doesn't at this point, right?
34,000-acre block will generate an awful lot of oil and gas if it's done properly and in consideration of the public's interest.
So do we know much about that 34,000 acres, Jack?
Have a lease sale and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and you raise a great question, and that is, what is the cost? What is the benefit? You know, any smart business woman or businessman would want to answer that question before they go down the road here, go hog wild. Tom is right that, you know, it'll be a parcel-by-parcel consideration. But the legislation that is pending would propose kind of whole cloth that all state lands are now available for drilling, and that there should be a standard lease that shall be in place. So when I see a standard lease, and maybe the sub-bill has changed that, I'm not certain, it kind of starts to tie the state's hands. But it's interesting that we're halfway down the road here. We're ramping up to a House committee vote, and a House floor vote next week on the industry proposal. The Kasich administration has a narrower proposal to their credit. It is not all state lands. It's state parks only. To their credit, it is not this oil and gas leasing board or commission. It would be the department making that decision. Again, now, my organization, we oppose the fundamental question of drilling in parks, but to the Kasich administration's credit, they have leased it. They have narrowed that. But the point is, here we are, pretty well in this debate. No one can give you a good third-party objective estimate of what is the revenue. It seems like you'd want to know that estimate before you turn on the green light.
Tom Stewart, how do the taxpayers of Ohio, how does the state of Ohio get a good third-party estimate?
Well, let's get a third party. Let's go to the state of Michigan, where they had one lease sale last year that generated $178 million. Let's go to another third party called the state of Pennsylvania. They had one lease sale on one block that generated $128 million last year and filled a budget gap for the state of Pennsylvania. Let's take a look at the Michigan program that's been in place for over 80 years and has generated massive funds that have been plowed back into state-owned properties and the acquisition of even more state properties for a great recreation state. That's existed peaceably with the citizens of Michigan for over 80 years. Ohio is way behind the curve on this issue. Meanwhile, they got a $500 million shortfall of properties they can't take care of, and somebody's going to have to fix these properties up. Our proposal says, well, let the properties help themselves to fix it up instead of getting on the taxpayers' back.
We're talking about proposals to allow gas drilling on some state lands. My guests are Jack Shaner from the Ohio Environmental Council, and you just heard from Tom Stewart. He's from the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. If you have a question or comment for our guests for the topic, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tell our screener right away, are you for or against drilling on state land, so we can make sure that the calls come out pretty even. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Join us Thursday morning for special coverage of President Obama's speech on the Middle East and U.S. policy there. NPR will have coverage of the speech and analysis of the president's remarks. Listen tomorrow morning beginning at 11:20 on 89.7 NPR News. And you can get access to our station anytime online at WOSU.org. Hear local and national news all day, every day, from the convenience of your computer by streaming on the web. Listen to 89.7 NPR News online anytime at WOSU.org. It's 53 degrees in downtown Columbus. There's a chance of rain off and on throughout the day today, maybe a thunderstorm later today, and a high of 60 degrees. There's a chance of rain for tonight as well, a low of 51. And unfortunately, that chance of rain is still here for Thursday, a high of 64, and then partly sunny for Friday, a high of 73. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about oil and gas drilling being permitted on some state lands. Bill was introduced by State Representative David Hall. He's the chairman of the House's Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. It's considered a compromise, and it would put state land into one of four classes, allowing energy companies the most access to property that is free of legal restrictions or mineral rights issues, which I guess, Tom Stewart, we're talking about that 34,000 acres or so. Is that what we're talking about when they say that?
Yeah, the subbill contemplated putting four classes of land in place. The first class would be where there is no encumbrance, and so it'd be easier to go and evaluate that and step that up for some kind of development. The other three classes contemplate encumbrances. The class two is the federal issue. Class three would be very de minimis lands. Department of Transportation is a good example. A highway runs through a drilling unit. And so it's a very small piece of land that could only be used by one person for one specific purpose. They should be free to go ahead and do those deals. And then the fourth is state lands that are donated by some kind of deed restriction. Nature preserves would probably be a really good example of this, mm-hmm. where the deed said, you can only use this for nature preserves, period. And it identifies those and takes them off the table.
Why does identifying it as a nature preserve, period, take it off the table? Because proponents of the drilling say it won't hurt the environment. So, and you can barely see the drilling operations once they're set up.
Stop and think about it. I mean, one of the examples that constantly comes up is that somebody's going to drill a well in the devil's bathtub in the middle of Old Man's Cave. That's not practical. And nobody is contemplating setting up a drilling operation in places like the Hocking Hills State Parks or preserves that are around that type of thing. So why even get into that kind of debate? Those are pretty sensitive areas, and I anticipate there will probably be amendments addressing nature preserves. And
more specifically?
You could drill it directionally, but it's probably going to be just taken off the table.
On that point, and quickly, I guess I would say we appreciate the delineation here and the recognition that we agree, nature preserves, clearly the intent is that thou shalt be no development, including drilling. So I appreciate that part, the recognition of the bill, but the reality is legally I'm not sure we've gained anything. It's merely recognizing or acknowledging, okay, there are federal land, there are state lands acquired with federal dollars, there's a question. So we won't drill there. And then there's nature preserves, which is clearly intent. Articles of Education shall not drill. But that hasn't really protected anything additionally. And then I would point out, and we're still examining the bill, to be fair here, the bill's just come out and lawmakers are still
The bill introduced this week, yeah.
Correct. The substitute, substitute in House Bill 133. But I see a section here. This number won't mean much to folks, but if you go to page 23 real quickly, Anne, mm-hmm. of this section 1509.76, a state agency that has classified a parcel of property as a Class 2 property, that is, as Tom just suggested here, it's got a federal encumbrance, that state agency, so if you got a Class 2, that agency shall make a reasonable effort to take appropriate actions so that the property may be reclassified as a Class 1 property. So it's saying, well, we're not just going to accept right here off the bat and take it off the table necessarily. We're going to – that state agency has the opportunity to work to resolve that federal encumbrance. Now, I don't know if that potentially could suggest, like Lake Erie today under federal law, you cannot drill in Lake Erie by federal law. So I don't know if that's an encumbrance, and this is encouraging the state of Ohio to go to Congress and try to get that lifted or not. But
that would be up to the prerogative of the state to do that.
Clearly, absolutely. Okay. And this is kind of encouraging get rid of these encumbrances.
The state would have to, on its own volition, go parcel by parcel go through the litigation or whatever would have to happen to free it up from the federal control or whatever.
And whether Lake Erie is real or not, clearly the language says it shall make reasonable efforts to resolve this Class 2 and try to open it up again. So even though Class 2 ostensibly is off the table, this section of the bill says try to get it back on the table.
Well,
Tom Stewart?
It's just as I described, Jack. It says that if there's an encumbrance and it can be resolved, make an effort to try to resolve it. And if you can, you can. If you can't, you can't. Lake Erie is off limits because the federal government took away from Ohio's citizens the ability to control their property, which, whether you're for drilling in Lake Erie or not, should offend every Ohio citizen. So, but the bottom line is Lake Erie is just too emotional. We just ought to let the Canadians do it, and they have. And And, you know, they've gotten, as a matter of fact, Canadians have drilled up entirely their whole side and have stopped drilling because there's nowhere else for them to go. So just let them have it, you know.
When I'm reading articles in the newspapers about this issue, I read the readers' comments, there's always a lot of drill baby drills out there. I don't see any drill baby drills on my screen telling me that they're calling in. So if you're a drill baby drill person out there, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you're for drilling on state lands, if you're for opening that up to drilling and for natural gas, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Theodore from Kent, you're opposed to drilling on state lands. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I recently testified in Columbus on April 6th at the hearing there against drilling in our state parks. And I'll tell you why. I've been studying this for nearly 4 years now, have a vast file of information on it. And reference was made earlier in the program to drilling in Pennsylvania state parks. I can tell you there is ample evidence that it is a highly destructive practice, and many, many Pennsylvania residents are deeply sorry that they ever allowed it. Now, 99.5% of our lands are now available under private leases. Why do we need to give the last one-half of 1% of these lands to drillers? These are owned by our taxpayers. And there's abundant evidence in peer-reviewed journals, and I could give you the references if you want, that hydraulic fracturing is a highly destructive practice. It affects our water supplies, to say the very least, uses anywhere from 3 to 8 million gallons of water for each well. Water is a precious resource.
But it's a way to drill without upsetting the landscape above.
It is certainly not a way to drill without upsetting the landscape above.
Okay.
Do you realize what the trucks are spilling? Do you realize the devastation to the roads and so forth that's mm-hmm. created by these trucks? You really need to look at the evidence here. I would just suggest we've got to leave our parks alone. They really represent one of the very few places that we citizens have left to take our families for some peace and for some appreciation of nature. Why do we need to go into these state park lands owned by taxpayers and begin to destroy them? And you can't tell me that they aren't a destructive practice. I can cite evidence for you, ample evidence, that they are highly destructive. So
okay.
I just can't buy the statement that they are not that they don't disturb the surface. They certainly do.
Thank you, Theodore. We have talked about fracking before. We'll probably be talking about fracking again. It is an issue in the state of Pennsylvania. Tom, you brought it up. I was going to bring it up as well. Fracking is the process of creating fissures in underground formations to allow natural gas to flow. And during that process, water, sand, and other additives are pumped under high pressure into the shale formation to create fractures, ergo fracking. Frack fluid is approximately, about 99.5% water and sand, as far as I could tell, and a little bit of additive. The sand is used to prop open the newly created fractures, which allow the natural gas to flow into the wellbore and up to the surface. Hydraulic fracking is typically performed only once in the life of a well. That's according to one source. Most people agree on those facts. The damage, however, is a different issue. And fracking is the form of drilling that we're largely talking around, necessarily talking about, particularly in that really valuable shale formations in Ohio. Tom?
Fracking has nothing to do with drilling. Hydraulic fracturing is a process that's been in place in the state of Ohio for nearly 60 years.
But that's the what we're talking about as far as
fracturing. Hydraulic fracturing is the process when you're completing a well and getting it ready to go into production.
Mm-hmm.
It's not part of the drilling process. It's there to induce permeability, to create a fracture back into the oil and gas bearing rock, so that oil and gas will flow more efficiently to the wellbore. The track record for hydraulic fracturing is very good. In fact, you will find regulator after top regulator who will say and testify, under oath they have testified, that they have never correlated underground hydraulic fracturing to contamination of underground USDWs or drinking sources. That's the fact in the state of Ohio. There's been over 80,000 wells fractured in the state of Ohio since the early 1950s.
But there have been lots of reports of problems in Pennsylvania. Jack, can you tell us about those?
That's absolutely right, Ann. And your caller is correct there. I think even Tom has acknowledged there have been hiccups over there. Nice euphemism for some of the serious problems in Pennsylvania. To the point, I believe, that the state Department of Environmental Quality recently has put called a timeout there because of problems, I believe. But, you know, fracking has everything to do with drilling. Tom just told us of the tens of thousands of wells that have been fracked in Ohio. It's got everything to do. What is new is this last 5 years or so developed this new technology where now the industry can get to those deeper Utica and Marcellus formations, which is where the real motherlode of oil and gas is located. And, again, 99% of Ohio, ladies and gentlemen, all private property with that owner's permission. The Wayne National Forest, our largest single tract of public lands, 250,000 acres. Whether I like it or not, all the state forests, all the state wildlife areas are today open for oil and gas drilling. That leaves a little bit of land, our parks and preserves. Let's keep them free, frack-free zone.
Mike, you're neutral on the issue. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask a simple question about, and it's concerning our oil and gas rights, our mineral rights. Why is it that a few people get to own these things when these are the natural resources of the United States?
I guess I don't understand what your question is.
Our natural resources belong to the American people. Why don't we pay these guys for getting them out of the ground and put the profits into the government coffers?
That's easy. Well, that's easy to take,
Tom Stewart?
Because in this country, people own property. And their property includes their mineral rights down to the center of the earth. You can't take somebody's property. The United States is a free country. And if you own oil and gas in your property, you own water or coal or aggregates or whatever you own underneath your property, it's yours. And so it's just not a few people that owns it. Every landowner out there owns it, and they're free to exploit it. They can drill their own well, but if they don't have the expertise or capital to do it on their own, they can go to somebody who does.
Yeah, your caller brings up a good point. The state government has promised when we set these lands aside, we'd always keep our parks free of commercial and industrial activity. You know, we've got state nature preserves, the most protection, state parks, which have more recreation in them than the preserves, state forests, state wildlife areas. They have different management goals, different missions. Our parks have always been managed to be free of this sort of commercial industrial activity. Let's keep them that way.
Mike, thanks for that call. And Greg, you are pro drilling, I'm told. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell us what your point of view is.
Well, you know, we need to get our oil and our natural gas here at home because we're spending all of our money in the Middle East and our kids are dying over there when we got the stuff right here in America. I don't know how else to put it.
Okay, Jack Shaner, Greg's making the point that we need to use our own natural resources. We need to lessen our reliance on foreign energy sources.
Well,
this is one way to do that.
Sure. Let's acknowledge America depends upon oil and gas. Yes, we need to develop other technologies and do those soon. But, you know, it's for the near future, for many years to come, oil and gas is going to continue to be a tremendous part of our energy portfolio. So, yes, we do need to develop it. And, yes, we need to become more energy independent. Ladies and gentlemen, 99.5% of Ohio is already open today to oil and gas drilling. Do we not want to set aside some lands and protect those lands from commercial activity, industrial activity? When you go to a park, you want to get away from it all. You don't want to be reminded of the industrial hubbub that is modern-day life.
Tom Stewart?
Well, a couple of points on that. They're great. The parks are great for recreation, and that's true, and that is their original and primary purpose. The only problem is the state of Ohio can't take care of it. They can't take care of it to the tune of $500 million. So here's a resolution that other states have done and have done well over time. As to the caller's comments, I understand his frustration. But the bottom line is, with the new technologies that have been developed, to extract this shale oil and gas, we are producing vast more amounts of oil and gas, and we're actually lowering prices when compared to world oil prices. So it is working, and people shouldn't be dying for oil.
Thanks, Greg, for that question. I wanted to go back to something that Theodore raised earlier in the program about the collateral damage, if you will, of these kinds of operations, the wear and tear on roads and other kinds of things like that. Now, when there's a lease contract, can it include reclamation for all of those things as well?
And absolutely.
We're talking about reclamation...
Reclamation
is a very specific word.
It is a very specific word in the Ohio Revised Code Chapter 1509,
right,
which says when this well must be reclaimed back to original contour and to the satisfaction of the landowner. And the state of Ohio is going to put together terms and conditions for these leases that are going to make it incredibly strict on how you manage the surface.
But if they make it incredibly strict, might it not deter the very revenue that they're shooting for here?
No, what it's going to do is it's going to attract the capitalized producers who are willing to take on that risk and meet those obligations.
Who can afford to. Jack?
Well, you know, you've got unavoidable impacts. You can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs, no question about that. Tom and I would both agree when you have drilling, you're going to have to get to the well site. You're going to have to go in there long after that drilling rig is gone and continue to maintain that site safely. We'd all agree with that. So you're going to have access roads. If there's not a pipeline nearby to convey the gas, you're going to have to build a pipeline. You may have to drill it. Put in battery tanks to hold the oil, and you have to go in and get that oil out. So it's long after the drilling rigs are gone, you have these unavoidable impacts. If all goes well, incidents, fine, but you're still going to have unsightly impacts, which means you've got kind of two choices here. One, you're going to have to set up in a place that is visible, and I think we'd all agree, well, you don't want it next to the bathhouse, the beach, the sand bunker, golf course, the campground. So now, well, you're going to have to go now to a more remote, less visible part of the park, which means you're probably going to have to be chopping through a forest, you know, to get to that, crossing streams, going around wetlands. And so now you're impacting the very character of what makes a park so special. It's just kind of a loss leader. Tom sees windfall, I see pitfalls.
I'm going to read an email from Dale, or I'm sorry, a message from Dale on Facebook, and then leave it to you, Tom Stewart, to finish up the program. Dale writes, do we need more environmental disasters? I say no. There is plenty of evidence this is not the way to the future. We have to ramp up alternative energy and stop the fossil fuel madness. Drilling, fracking, deforestation, what's next? We are not going to be environmental slaves to the corporations. Tom Stewart?
Oh, that sounds like a political statement to me. I'm not sure how to respond to that. I'm sure this person drives cars.
Tom, you have no
experience
with political statements.
You know, that was
Tom
sloganeering. And you know, how do you respond to sloganeering?
Well,
you know, get in your car and drive home.
Well, I want to thank my guests, Jack Shaner from the Ohio Environmental Council. Jack, thanks for joining
us
today.
Ann.
And also Tom Stewart from the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. Tom, thanks for rejoining
really
us.
Really enjoyed it.
And we'll get more deeply into this issue as things evolve or devolve, depending on what side of the issue you're on. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Chaos in North Africa.
Tanks, helicopters, and military aircraft have reportedly been used indiscriminately to attack the protesters.
Government gunmen fired on protesters after Friday prayers.
There is an enormous fury here that the leader of this country has turned the guns on his own people.
The quest for democracy turns violent. NPR News is there. On 89.7 NPR News.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher today, coming up in 20 minutes, hour two of the program, and a discussion of high school proms in Central Ohio, after prom parties, and the LGBT students at the prom. Join us for that and more on hour two of All Sides with Ann Fisher, beginning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU Public Media.
And there are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or like WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter at WOSU.org/email. And it's 53 degrees with some light rain, a chance of showers off and on throughout the day today, a high of 60 degrees. Also a chance of rain, maybe a thunderstorm tonight, a low of 51. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. State lawmakers are pondering a House-passed budget that would cut state aid to nursing homes by $427 million during the next 2 years. A perennial political force, the nursing home lobby this time is facing losses. Last week, an association representing 750 nursing homes and residential care facilities lashed out with a bruising ad bashing the governor. The ad has been pulled for now, but the standoff continues at the State House. Here's Governor Kasich responding to the ads.
The ones that are now putting these ads on television to scare our senior citizens, it's not acceptable. Ohio spends more per person on nursing home care than all but five states.
Joining us today to talk about that is Dispatch reporter Kathy Kandisky, who's been covering the issue. Kathy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
You know, I want to get at that statement that the governor made, that Ohio spends more on nursing home care than all but five states. That's old statistics.
2004 data.
Yeah. Do we have anything, you know, like newer? You know,
not on that. What he's referring to there is Ohio pays more on nursing home care per capita than all but five other states. Those stats were from the Kaiser Family Foundation from 2004, so they're old. And the other thing is that those stats represent payments to nursing homes from all sources, private pay, Medicaid, everything. The budget is just dealing with what the state will pay nursing homes to care for Medicaid-eligible Ohioans. So it's a big chunk of what nursing homes make, because many people in nursing homes are on Medicaid, of course.
So do we know how Ohio ranks in terms of what the state actually contributes?
Yeah, I think the better data maybe, or the certainly more current, is the daily per-person rate that the state pays. Currently, Ohio pays $177 per day per person for nursing home care. That is about, both sides agree, that is about $4.75 more than the national average. This budget would take that daily rate from $177 down to $164, $13. So with that, we'd be under the average. And it translates to about, I think, a 7% cut.
And when we look at these rankings, are we looking at just raw dollars, or are there other factors considered, like the cost of living? In other words, is it cheaper to have a nursing home in Santa Fe, New Mexico, than it is in Columbus, Ohio?
Yeah, the 177 is an average state rate. They vary county to county, and of course the person's level needs. You know, some folks in nursing homes need little care, some need great deal of care, so the rates are, that's an average. That 177 is an average daily rate.
My guest is Kathy Kandisky. She's a reporter for the Columbus Dispatch and covers Medicaid and pretty much all things Medicaid. Right now we're talking about nursing homes. They stand to lose about $427 million during the next 2 years if the state budget as written goes through. If you have a question or comment for Kathy, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So a few weeks ago, the Ohio Healthcare Association, which paid for that ad, met with administration officials and leaders from the Ohio House and Senate. What came of that meeting?
Well, all the Medicaid providers are having their rates cut. The nursing homes are having a bigger cut than the other providers. There's 3% cuts for some others. Theirs is a 7% cut. They have been the only interest group that I'm aware of that is actually running television commercials protesting those cuts. Those ads, as you showed earlier with the comments from the governor, have really irked the governor's office. You might recall that before he took office, Governor Kasich cautioned special interests that he had no time for their pressure or their lobbying. He made that famous comment about he'll, you know, get on the bus or I'll run you over with the bus. So the nursing homes, he's obviously chasing them down in the bus right now. He's angry that they've pushed back on this issue. He's angry by those ads. And the timing of the ads, that ad, the last ad in particular that they ran that showed somebody pulling the plug as if, you know, pulling the plug on someone's life and then a flat EKG indicating the person was dying and then attributing it all to Kasich's cuts. He got pretty angry about that ad, and that ad started airing one day after the nursing home representatives met with the governor's Medicaid person and the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate to discuss the cuts. So they felt blindsided by the ad. They felt that they had, you know, met with them and acted in good faith and were going to talk about the impact of the cuts. But the nursing home's perspective on that, because I asked them about that as well, they said, well, yeah, we did meet, but there was no promise of anything. There was no talk about we're going to work on this or we're going to try and, you know, find some more money for you. There was nothing, so they felt they would go ahead and run the ad and turn up the heat. Well, when the governor pushed back, of course, they pulled that ad pretty quick.
Also, legislators are complaining about the ad, too, because it makes them look just as bad. You know, this is something I wanted to ask about on Columbus on the Record over the weekend, and I didn't get to it, so I'll ask you now. Is the fact that the nursing homes have always been a powerhouse, as long as I covered the legislature, you know, going back way back, you know, 20, 30 years now, I'm sorry, I'm dating us now.
I wasn't born.
But Kathy was not around then, so I'll speak for that period. Anyways, They've always had a lot of power. They've always had a lot of money. They've doled it out. And that's usually the end of it. They've never had an ad like this. Does this speak to their power or does it speak to their waning power that they're going to throw an ad like that out there?
I think it speaks to their waning power. I mean, as you might recall, this is an industry that had their rates set by statute. And so when everyone, all the other Medicaid providers, primary care docs, hospitals, everyone else that takes care of Medicaid patients, was seeing their rates cut in previous budgets. The nursing homes had guaranteed increases in state law. That's the way it was for years. The last few governors, I know Governor Strickland, I know certainly Governor Taft before him, so Republican and Democratic administrations have tried to get that out of statute because it's just not fair as they were having to make cuts. The nursing homes always been able to fight back on it. You know, they make a lot of campaign contributions. They're a strong lobby. These lawmakers, you know, they all have nursing homes. They all have constituents who have family, parents in nursing homes. It's tough. They hear about it. But the nursing homes have always been able to fight back. I think this ad speaks directly to the fact that their power, their influence, at least under this governor, appears to be quite threatened.
Well, I was going to say, now that we're, you know, pretty much hip deep in the aging baby boomer generation, everyone knows someone, really, who's in a nursing home or should be in a nursing home or could be in a nursing home soon. Everyone has a stake in it. And could there be more ads? Because there's a very, very large constituency out there of people who are worried about the care of their loved ones.
I think there's no question that if the nursing homes don't get some, I think they've requested, as you mentioned, their cuts are about $427 million mm-hmm. over the biennium. They've requested, I think, about $200 million restored. I think if you see that happen, I don't think you'll see any more ads. But they've got more ads. They'll go back up on the air with more ads. They'll turn up the heat. I mean, there's a lot at stake from their perspective.
Did anybody measure whether those ads did anything?
Not that I know.
In terms of public opinion?
Well, you know, I know the lawmakers are getting a lot of calls because they do. Of course, they always include the number.
So I call your legislator now.
So they were obviously getting calls on it.
One of the responses from the administration and from lawmakers who support these cuts is that they're going to strengthen Ohio's Passport program and give people more options and more access to at-home care to get people out of the nursing homes. And Dale from Columbus, you wanted to talk about that. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yes, I have a question for Kathy, mm-hmm. and that would be, I think everybody would applaud the governor's intent to increase options for seniors. I mean, poll after poll has shown that most seniors, by a wide majority, would rather receive long-term health care at home than they would in nursing homes if they possibly can. So So that's probably a good thing to rebalance that. However, if you're going to do that, and more seniors will presumably choose to receive at-home care, where are we going to come up with the home health care workers to serve them?
Go ahead, Dale.
I was going to say, right now, as I understand it, full-time at-home care workers earn about $30,000 a year if they work full-time, and they don't have benefits themselves. In other words, they are giving home health care, and they don't have health insurance themselves.
Dale, just wait a minute. Oh. Dale, in the spirit of full disclosure, tell us your last name and who you work for.
Butland is my last name, mm-hmm. and I work for Innovation Ohio.
Okay. So, Kathy?
Yeah, Dale, I think it was in the New York Times, an interesting article about healthcare workers, not just the home care workers that you mentioned, but nursing home workers, too, that don't have health insurance. So it's a real issue. But back to the original point you made, mm-hmm. you're right. The overall effort here is to rebalance Ohio's long-term care system and to put more people into home and community-based services, which the state can provide at a much cheaper cost.
That's the long-term goal, and thanks, Dale, for that call. We appreciate it. That's the long-term goal, but they want to make these changes in the course of 2 years.
Yeah.
How do you get that many people, you know, on the ground working?
It's gonna be tough because they're talking about moving people out of nursing homes that don't really need to be there. You know, sometimes people go into a nursing home after hospitalization, they don't intend to stay there permanently, but after a while, it becomes harder and harder for them to move out. So they end up there. So they're going to need to move people out of nursing homes, and then people who suddenly become in need of care, more care than maybe they can get at home, will need services set up for them. Maybe it's a visiting aide a couple times a week, or whatever it is. So that's where it's going to be tough. But what they want to do as Ohio's population ages, they want to try and get more and more folks funneled into the home and community-based services than nursing homes, as many as they can.
And when you say community-based services, we're talking about daycare programs, places people can stay during the day but stay in their home at night,
the most
and that kind
popular
of thing.
Is the Passport program. Mm-hmm. It's a home care program. They come in and they assess your needs, and they set up a program around those needs. Maybe it's, I was just talking to a lady yesterday who has her mother in the Passport program. It allows her mother to continue living with her and her husband, but the woman works every day. So she needs someone there during the day while she's at work to look after her mom.
How
That's
can
what
it
they
be
provide.
Cheaper to have one person come to your home and spend the day there than to have, you know, have that economies of scale of people in nursing homes?
That's a good question.
I'm also wondering about the other factors like the cost of gasoline. I mean, if people are driving around going to people in their homes, there are other factors involved.
That's an expense. Sure it is.
That's going up. We have an email from Tom in Waverly. He writes, I've been told that nursing homes get money from the state for empty beds, which has something to do with holding space for a certain number of Medicaid patients. Is this true?
That is true. That's true. What the state does is say there's a Medicaid patient in a nursing home, and say that Medicaid patient gets sick and has to go to the hospital. The state will pay to hold that bed. I think right now they pay up to 30 days to hold that bed, which is kind of ridiculous, people argue, because the statewide vacancy rate at nursing homes is 15%. So while some nursing homes may be at capacity, not all are. What Kasich's budget will do is reduce the rate that they pay to hold a bed and the duration. They're only going to pay to hold a bed for 15 days, and I think it's about half. They're going to pay about half of what they pay now to hold that bed. There just isn't the same need to hold beds like there used to be.
The governor wants nursing homes to consolidate as well after the losses, after people move out and get into more home care and due to expanded home care options. And some folks are worried that they're going to have to travel farther for the folks that do have to be in a nursing home. They can't be cared for at home. They're going to have to travel. There'll be fewer options for them.
That's the argument I hear. You know, the administration threw out a statistic last week on that access issue, and they said that about 98% of Medicaid patients currently live within 10 miles of a nursing home. So I think their perspective is that even if some homes do close, people are going to still live pretty close to nursing homes. But you know, the person who sent that in is from Waverly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some of those rural areas, I have to believe that access and proximity would certainly be an issue if homes are starting to close.
So what are you hearing from people when you're out there talking about this to them? How much do people know about it? How are they responding?
Well, I mean, people see the ads. I think people in nursing homes, I think lawmakers will tell you that they've gotten calls from constituents. They've gotten calls from nursing home residents and nursing home residents' families who are very, very worried about the implications of these cuts. So I think there's a real concern out there. I think the administration and lawmakers are having to explain, you know, throw some of these statistics out, throw kind of their overall goals out to try and, you know, mitigate some of these arguments.
Scott from Columbus, we have just a sec, but you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. For several years, I took care of my mother at home, and their passport was discussed at the time. And there was an issue at the time. I'm wondering if it's still true, that you had to be Medicaid eligible in order to be on passport.
That's true. Okay. That is true. All these programs we're talking about are for Medicaid eligible Ohioans.
I see. All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Scott, for the call. Lost jobs. The industry is projecting some 7,000 jobs will be lost, but the administration is saying, well, yes, but they'll be made up in the at-home.
I guess. I mean, it's a good argument. You know, this governor's all about job creation, and, of course, this would cost jobs according to the nursing homes. So, you know, that's a real issue. The nursing home lobby has some decent arguments on this. They're taking a bigger cut than anybody else. They're no greater part of the Medicaid budget today than they have been in the last couple of years. They've really kind of, their funding has been flat, whereas some other provider groups, hospitals and others have gone up. And, you know, there are some good arguments about it. But, you know, ultimately, I think, yeah, they want to shift this whole sector over to the home and community-based care. Then, as Dale mentioned earlier, there's some issues with the pay on that, too.
Well, that's all the time we have for this topic today. I want to thank you, Kathy Kandisky, for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's it on Medicaid for now. It's an ongoing conversation, and we will continue it. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Mm-hmm.